Bhakti-bodhitam bhagavata narayanena swayam vyasena kathitam purana-munina madhye mahabharatam advaita-mrita-varshinim bhagavatim ashtadashadhyayinim ambatvam-anusantadhami Bhagavad-gītē bhavad-parishini.
Okay, so we're on chapter 18, verse 43, during the kshatriya karma.
Shauryam tejo dhritirdaksham Shauryam tejo dhritirdakshyam yudhe chapya palayanam dhanamishwara bhavascha kshatram karma swabhavajam Shauryam Tejas, Dhritihi, Daksham, Yudhe, Cha, Api, Apalayanam.
I have some dyslexia there, so the Apalayanam.
Dhanam Ishwara Bhavaha Cha Kshatram Karma Svabhavajam.
Okay. So Kshatram Karma Svabhavajam says these qualities are what is natural to the Kshatriya. Kshatram is the Kshatriya. Kshatriya is primarily Rajas with Sattva. Okay. And so Shauryam means bravery and courage. Tejas is that kind of brilliance and confidence. Swamiji uses confidence. It's a brilliance, it's a confidence. It's an energy, a confident energy. You know? Dhritihi is, sometimes we call dhritihi fortitude. It means you don't give up. You have a vision, something needs to be done, and you continue doing it until you accomplish it. That's dhriti. The single-pointedness, you don't back down, you fulfill your mission. That's dhriti, fortitude. Daksham is interesting. That is being, you could say it's being clever, but what is meant by that is when you get into a situation that you've never been in before, and you have to figure out a way to handle that situation. You have the wherewithal and the creativity, you know, and the skill to figure out a path to handle that difficult situation. So you can imagine Kshatriya often means, you know, warriors, people who are in war or fighting. They're going to be getting into situations that are always kind of fresh and new, and they have to be able to figure out a path through that situation, or what is the best way to handle. That's daksha, that ability to kind of be clever, to use your intelligence in a creative way, not just rote. A lot of times we're habituated to things and we know what to do in the situation and we do it over and over and over again. But this is not that. This is, your mind is flexible and creative and can figure out a pathway to get you through a difficult situation. That's daksha. It doesn't have to be a difficult situation, but when you're thinking of the Kshatriyas and being in war, and this is taking place right in the middle of the Mahabharata war, you know, where there's so much conflict. And when you read the Mahabharata also, you see this daksha coming into play all of the time, how they get out of these, you know, very life-threatening situations, how creative they have to be, and how quick, how fast. You know, how confident. So all of these kind of play together with a certain type of mindset for the Kshatriya. Then another one he says is yude and also cha api, cha and api also yude in war, in combat, apalayanam. Palayanam means running away. Apalayanam means no running away. So no running away in combat. In fact, Swamiji tells a story that in war, when the Kshatriyas have been wounded, and so they make their way, they make their way home to the front lines, or whatever you call that, you know, where the hospitals are, where the women are there to take care of them, you know. As long as they've been shot in the front, they take care of them. If they've been shot in the back, then that's a dishonor. You know, I guess they kind of push them away. It's a story. But you understand that running, you don't run away, you know. You have to face it head on. That's so that no running away in war. No turning your back, no turning your face. Sada Shankara says, for Apalayanam, Shankara says, Aparang Mukhi Bhavaha. He says, not turning your face in the opposite direction. Yeah. You know, like I'm looking at you, and now I'm not, because I'm going the other way. That's what he says. Now, another one here is Dhanam. Dhanam means there's a generosity, a giving, a freedom of giving. And how Shankara talks about Dhanam, I really like this. He says, for Dhanam, Dhanam means giving. Okay? Deya Dravyeshu Mukta Hastata. Mukta means his hasta's hands. The state of having your hands open, this would be clenched, mukta would be released. Your hands are released toward those dravyas, those things, dam, which should be given. Deya means not inappropriate gifts. But dravyas are any type of object. Anything can be a dravya. So a dravya which is deya, a dravya which is to be given. So toward these things that are meant to be given or necessary to be given, their hands are completely open. So there's an openness, there's a generosity there, open-handed. And the next one is Ishvara Bhava. The Ishvara Bhavaha means that they have the capacity, the that bhava is that attitude of being a ruler, being a commander. And so say you're responsible for a group of people, or you're the president, or you're the king, or you're the commander of an army, but you yourself don't have that bhava, that attitude, you know, that state of being, that affect of leadership, then it's going to be hard for anybody to follow you. You know, because you yourself don't have that inside of you. And so that bhava, the word bhava, like sometimes when they're talking about somebody who's singing bhajans, they'll say, oh, they have such a beautiful bhava. It means that the bhajans that they're singing, it has invoked in the singer, all of those feelings, you know, are there, evident in the song. And so some singers are always kind of praised, and people go to hear them just for, they call in Hindi that bhav, because that love or devotion is actually manifesting through the song. And so here Ishwara doesn't mean Ishwara, it means the one who commands, the one who is a leader. So that Ishwara bhava, that sense of leadership, that being a leader is something which exudes from them. See what I mean? That's Ishvara Bhava. And so for a Kshatriya, the Kshatriyas are the leaders, they're the warriors, the commanders, the leaders, they're the political leaders. These are all the Kshatriyas. And so they have to have that leadership quality or they can't lead. You know? And also, if we're talking about the Kshatriyas who are enjoying sattva, they should also have generosity and goodness, and that you should feel protected by them. You should feel supported by them. That the leader has some sattva. If they have sattva, then that sense of goodness is there, rather than selfishness. Tamas will bring about more of the selfishness. Like, I want this for my sake. Where the sattva would be, as a leader, I want to take care of my people, you know. So Kshatriya should be primarily Rajas, which gives them all of that energy, you know, and with Sattva, secondary. So they have a certain shanti and goodness and sense of well-being. So that's Ishvara Bhava. It says, Kshatram Karma Svabhavajam. These are the type of qualities that are natural for the Kshatriya. Okay? So let's do the next one. It's good enough. Then, Krishi Gaurakshavanijyam, Vaishya Karma Svabhavajam, Parichariyatmakam Karma, Shudrasyapi Svabhavajam, Krishi Gau Raksha Vanijyam Vaishya Karma. So Vaishya Karma Svabhavajam. Then Paricharyatmakam Karma Shudrasya Api Svabhavajam. First line is the Vaishya, second line is the Shudra. So the Vaishya are Rajas and Tamas. Rajas with secondary Tamas. And the Shudra are Tamas, secondarily Rajas. Okay? If you're going to classify them, these according to the gunas, which is what's being done here, basically. So for the Vaishyas are the people who are in all forms of agriculture. Krishi is agriculture. It's not just plowing the fields, but it's all taking care of the plants, taking care of the animals. But the animals, so Krishi, take Krishi just basically agriculture. Okay. But then, Gau Raksha says the protection of the cows. Mm-hmm. Raksha means protection. And so, of course, Swamiji talks about this. Why Raksha? Mm-hmm. You know? And he says, because the animals are to be protected, and in protecting the animals, they will serve you. Mm-hmm. But you have to... Your duty is to take care of them and protect them. Not like in industrialized farming when the animals are fattened and slaughtered and not given any type of protection. That won't bless you. So then he talks a little bit, you know. Dharma protects you. In your practice of Dharma, the Dharma will protect you. In your protection of Dharma, Dharma will protect you. In your protection of the animals will protect you. That's what he's saying. It's very beautiful, actually. And that's what they call when they're talking about cows. And cow, the go means cow. That can also be expanded. It literally means cow. But it also can include, like, all other animals, like farm animals. Now, mriga, the word mriga, deer, means deer. The word mriga can include all different kinds of wild animals. But go would include usually just cows, but it can also mean like sheep and other types and chickens and other types of animals like that, that are more farm animals. So in our care and protection of these animals, then they will care and protect us. You know? And then Swamiji moves into a talk about dharma and ahimsa and non-injury and what our responsibility is to other living beings. Ahimsa being really the highest dharma. That what's at the top of the pyramid, and when we're working on the meaning of dharma, that the top of the pyramid is ahimsa.
Sorry, Edward's microphone just fell.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
At the top of the pyramid is ahimsa, non-injury. So, and it's non-injury. Swamiji would say, when he talks about ahimsa, it's non-injury to all living beings. Ahimsa to all living beings. And so a beautiful word to understand, what does it mean, ahimsa to all living beings, is raksha. They are to be protected. So what are if human beings? They are to be cared for, they're to be protected. To be protected means their interests we should be primary to us. What do they need? That's raksha. We care about what they need. We care about protecting them. But usually our compassion, we can relate to it in terms of human beings, but we have to extend it farther. For our heart, for Dharma, we have to extend it farther to include much more than just human beings. The farther out you can go, the better you are. Better off you are, the farther out you can go in terms of taking care of living beings. I was telling my class the other day, and we were talking in at CIS, that, you know, in India they pray to the meadows when they're going to cut all the grass. When they cut all the grass, that grass is giving up its life. And so many creatures also are giving up their lives when those meadows are cut and plowed and vegetables and whatnot are planted. And so they do pujas and prayers, to all of that, because all of us have to eat. Human beings have to eat also, right? Animals have to eat, human beings have to eat, insects have to eat, we all have to eat. And so there's going to be some sacrifice of life in eating, because we don't eat rocks. We don't eat rocks. So life eats life. But then the question is, in terms of what do we eat, what do we choose to eat, and how, with what type of compassion do we decide on what food is right for us? That becomes a very important question, actually. And it goes so far, what do we choose to wear? Do we have to wear, is it necessary to wear leather? Is that necessary? In fact, in the sannyasis in India, when they meditate, they would meditate in the old days, they would meditate, outside in their tree, and they would need something to sit on. And so what was their favorite thing to sit on usually was deer skins. Sometimes tiger skins, but deer skins. But they would actually have to find a deer that had died of natural causes. And then that deer they would skin. They could never kill a deer so that they could have that deer skin. That would be an adharma. So it's just interesting. Our compassion, our sensitivity in this culture and in the world right now, for generations and generations, has not had that type of sensitivity, to what are we actually doing to those animals? So those animals are having to give up their life so that we can wear leather or wear fur. Why are we doing that? Some friend said the other day, we were talking about this, and she said and she hasn't given up leather. A lot of people haven't. And I have nothing to say about that, because it took me 4 years before I never used leather. But she said, there's a numbness. There's a numbness around it, where we're totally closed to this, something that's actually horrendous, but we're totally closed off to it. And in my opinion, honestly, and certainly Swamiji's, because he never stops talking about it, we have to open our hearts back up. We have to open, slowly, slowly open back up, and it takes, what you think it takes, is sacrifice on your part to give up these things that are social norms. You think it's a sacrifice, but actually it's not, once you do it. In fact, once you do it, there's tremendous peace and joy in doing that. And every time you don't wear leather, and every time you don't have a latte, you feel happy, because you're not participating in the horror of what we're putting these animals through. So people don't like to hear about this, but actually for us, as seekers, as mumukshus, as people who have a spiritual nature, we do have to think about this. You can't block it out, because it keeps your heart closed in a way that you don't even know. You don't even realize it, because it's been closed for generations and generations and generations to where it's just totally numb in that area. but making this small, what I, in the end is a very, very small price to pay for something that is much, much greater. It's a very, very small price, but because of the reward of it. But it doesn't seem like that initially, because you feel like you have to give up so much. You have to give up so much in giving up your pizzas and your latte and your cool shoes and leather bags and all of these type of things. It seems like a huge thing, and nobody else is doing it. You know, and so you don't want to move there. But in the actual, once you do make that move, the rewards are very, very great in terms of your heart, in terms of anybody else. But for you, in terms of your heart, it's very big. And so, of course, Swamiji had an opportunity, and I also took the opportunity. So he'll never miss an opportunity. He just can't, because it is that important, and people don't want to know about it. You know, but we can't be like that. We have to at least know about it, and you slowly take your time to own it up. But we have to know about it. And then step by step by step, you finally let all of it go. Next one is Vanijam. So there's the Krishi, Gauraksha. The Vanijam is commerce. Commerce has to do with also industry. So all corporations, all types of commerce are involved in Vanijam. And because Vaishya is tamas, bridges with tamas, in that commerce world, marketing world, there tends to be selfishness. It's tamasic. It tends to be selfishness, where it's about me and my money and my prosperity. And so if a person has come out of that selfishness in the that Vaishya world, then they have kind of a karma yoga buddhi. Then they have a spiritual attitude toward their work, which allows for sattva to predominate, which is what we're going to be, where all of this is leading. And so such a person who isn't really driven by that kind of greed or selfishness, or it's all about my success and how much money that I can make, you know, and how big of a house I can have, you know, and the doing better than the Joneses, all of this, that was really is there in kind of that commerce world. It's often all about money. If it's not all about money, there's something else going on. That's very beautiful, actually. It's true for the Kshatriyas also, and for the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are supposed to be like that. If they're not like that, then they're not living up to what it means for them to be a Brahmana. The Kshatriyas can also become Brahmanas by Guna, and the Vaishyas can become Brahmanas by Guna. But if they're not becoming Brahmanas by Guna, then this type of selfishness is usually predominant in that type of a world. So, so these three things, he says, are what is naturally the karma, the attitudes, the Vaishya attitudes. So they're into agriculture, the protecting of the cows, and commerce. It's usually rajas with tamas. So there's not a lot of self-reflection there. Just more doing. Doing, making money, being successful, running a good business. So. Then, Shudra. Now it says, Shudrasya api swabhavajam. Karma, Shudrasya api swabhavajam. The karma, the attitudes for the Shudra. Shudra is tamas, which tamas with rajas secondarily. So the Shudras are really running around with the hands and legs of all of the other people. They're the workforce, you know. Like say, if somebody's a farmer and they're into agriculture, then they're going to have a lot of helping hands. If they're in commerce, they're going to have a lot of people who are working for them. Those are the Shudras. Those are the people who are told what to do. They have specific duties, and they run around taking care of things. There's a workforce. The Shudras would be the workforce. And what is their basic karma is
Paricharyatmakam. Their nature is really to serve. Mm-hmm. So whoever their boss is working for, they have duties. They're to serve that particular institution, whatever it is, mm-hmm. or whoever their boss is. They're the ones who provide the service, do what needs to be done to make that business or whatever it is a success. Those are the Shudras. Okay? And so now, having gone through these four that are all really gunas, right? They're all just manifestations for different types of people. Point here, as Swamiji will keep unfolding as we go through, we don't have this caste system here. They really don't even have it in India anymore in any type of working way. The caste system, or the called Varna, caste is a translation, it's not a Sanskrit word, the word is Varna. So these four types of groups of people are there the world over. Like, I'm translating this into types of people, and you'll say, yes, I'm familiar with those types of people, and yes, with those types, and with those types, and with those types. So we have to think of it just in categories of types of people that maybe have these tendencies as dominant. And so now he's translating that, these kind of tendencies, as being dominant in terms of the gunas and the mix of the gunas and things like that. So now the question is, say for all of us, and not in the Bhagavad Gita, all of us could have been born by guna or by karma into any one of these four groups. And within these four groups, there's all kinds of subgroups. But just say, we'll just accept these four groups. We could be born into any of these four groups. But for us, we are mumukshas, right? And so now our relationship, because of being a mumukshu, a seeker, our relationship to our duties is going to be very much different. Our relationship to whatever duties we find ourselves in, you know, based upon, say, our caste, or based up here, it'd be based upon our families and our traditions and what life has to give us, the life we find ourselves in. So we have to say like that. So based on the life that we find ourselves in, it's now no longer geared toward power or money or success or fame or all of these type of things, or getting to heaven even. All of these type of worldly goals are not any longer what is dominant for us. It's not that I want to be a success, or the success-failure dyad is not dominant for us. The belief that if I could have lots of money and fame, then I would be a great person and therefore happy. these type of things are gone. They're gone because of vairagya. It's not that I don't think I need to make money. I have to make money to live. So whatever is there, whatever job that I have, whatever's been given to me in that way, I do that because I need to take care of myself. That is there. But I'm not, my goal is not on that. That's not what I'm about. As a mumukshu, I have that viveka and vairagya. And so I'm a seeker. I want to know what is actually the truth here and who actually am I. And so now, for me, the karma that I find myself in, the world that I find myself in, becomes my field, kshetra. The field for antakarna shuddhi. How do I live my life in this world that I find myself in? So just imagine, you know, a century ago, and they're studying the Gita, they would say, okay, well, I'm a kshatriya and these are my duties. This is the life that I find myself in. I'm a vaishya. I find myself, these are my responsibilities. These are my duties. This is what my father has passed on to me, because they pass on within family. So these are my responsibilities. The Brahmana would say the same thing. These are my responsibilities. These are my duties, what I need to do. The Shudra would say, these are my duties. These are what I need to do. And so now it becomes a matter of, how do I live in this life that's been given us? So for us, how do I live in this life that has been given to me, that is here right now? How do I live in this life in such a way that I can gain antakarna shuddhi? And so now, this is what we're getting into. This is the whole point of all of this. Because when Krishna was teaching Arjuna this, all of these varnas were the reality. And so he was talking about all of this in reference to the varnas because the duties were very clear, what each person had to do. They had very definite duties. They had even duties in relation, very spelled out duties in relationship to the family structure, how they were to treat their mate, how they're to treat their parents, how they're to treat their children. All of their responsibilities are very, very clear to them. How they're to treat their guests, you know, these things. What are the rituals that I need to do every day? What does Bhagavan say? As a Brahmana or as a Kshatriya, I have certain rituals. Both the man and the wife have certain rituals that they're supposed to do on a daily basis. They have responsibilities. So the duties are very clear. So for us, our duties are not that clear anymore. They're not as spelled out. And yet, they are clear. Because as life presents itself to me, what is the right thing to do, I'm often quite clear about. I don't always do what is being asked of me. But I'll feel guilty, you know, or kind of tamasic, right? Because I'm putting off what is being, or shunning, or shirking what is actually being asked of me in a given situation. And so now for me, it's imposed on us now for us to become alert to, you know, what are my duties in any given situation. So now, keeping that translation in mind, which is exactly how Swamiji deals with this, because we are even in India, we have to do it like this now. Okay. We move on. So let's see what Krishna says. He goes, Sway, sway, karmani bharataha. Sway, sway, karmani nipirataha. Samsiddhim labhate naraha. Samsiddhim labhate naraha. Sokarma nirata siddhim. Sokarma nirata siddhim. Yatha vindati tachvanu. Yatha vindati tachvanu. Sway, sway, karmani. See that sunny there? Karmani. Abhirataha. Samsiddhim labhate naraha. Swakarma nirataha siddhim yatha vindati tachrinu. He says, sway sway karmani, toward one's own karma. Karmani is in the locative, sway sway, toward one's own karma. So for each person, toward their individual karmas, means their duties. Here the karmas are, what are the duties that are being presented to me right now? What are my responsibilities? What are my duties? So, sway, sway, karmani, toward each one's karma's duties, abhirataha. Abhirataha means he revels. Shankara will talk, instead of revels, abhirataha means just to revel, means to enjoy. It also just means, Shankara will say too, to have a happy commitment, to be committed to, happily. And yet to be happily committed to my own duties. The things that are there in front of me to be due, that is what I want to do. My commitment is to do what is given to me to do. For the record, that's Ishvara Arpana Bhuti. We'll get into this later. I see all of this as what Bhagavan has given me. This is the life, the prarabdha that Bhagavan has given me. And so I know what my dharma is in this, what I'm supposed to be doing in this life, in this prarabdha karma that is unfolding. And so that's what I want to do. I want to do what Bhagavan has given me to do. I don't want that ahankara, that I notion, you know, the ahankara to come and say, I don't want to do that. I want to do this for my raga dvesha. That's those preferences. I don't want to do this because I want to do that. Why do you want to do that? Well, that would make me really happy. So my raga dvesha then causes me to make choices away from the dharma, can cause me to make choices away from what is really my responsibility in the moment? And so for that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where this life is really a devotion to Ishvara, how does that play out? What is the, how does that work? Well, it works in terms of doing what it's being asked to do, asked of me to do. That doesn't really require any choice. The choice becomes to do what I'm being asked to do or not to do what I'm being asked to do. If I just do what's obviously there, my duty, I don't even notice a choice. I'm just doing what I'm called on to do to the best of my ability every moment. I know I've said this so many times, but it has always made a huge difference to me. When Swamiji said this, somebody asked him some question about his own life, how he lives it, something like that, and he said, I do what is in front of me to be done every moment to the best of my ability. And then he said, and that's all. That's it. And I think that is it. That is it. Yeah, because the beauty is that the prarabdha karma, your life, your whole life, the whole experience of your life is the prarabdha karma. That's Ishvara. The prarabdha karma is the little piece of Ishvara that you get to enjoy with a limited mind and sense organs. Right? So the flow, this flow of life, it's not just this body, it's the flow of your life in which this body, mind, sense organs is contained. That's your prarabdha karma. And so in this flow of life, there are many challenges and things to be done and responsibilities that are there, that there's part of it. It's part of that flow of your life. And so then what do? Well, that's what you do. You do what is there to be done. What's the purpose of life? To do what is there to be done, moment by moment. You know? But in doing that, that's that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, one gains Antakarna Shuddhi. Because actually, in the commitment to that, these raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes, dissipate. Because this is my focus. This is what I do. So the raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, drop off, leaving a shantavritti. And so my mind enjoys a relative shanti, peace, which makes my mind and heart, actually, available for this knowledge. Because if my mind is twisted up with raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes, and trying to get this and trying to get that, it gets so busy and convoluted in trying to accomplish all of these things, the mind doesn't really enjoy shanti because it's too preoccupied with all of these worries and all of these things that have to be done. Whereas a mumukshu, what has to be done is just what is right here in front of you to be done. That's what has to be done. Nothing else, really. We start spinning, you know, on what will have to be done, what may have to be done, you know. What's going to happen if this happens, you know. And so you get used to reeling that in. You know what I'm saying? You get used to reeling it in. Oh, okay. Yeah. You get used to reeling that in.
I thought that was mine, maybe.
Oh, I didn't hear anything.
His recorder beeping. Not yours.
Oh.
David's.
Okay. Let's see if mine's up here. We're all
okay. He probably ran out of batteries.
Hang on, everybody.
But that seems to be how the mind works.
It works. That's why it naturally works that way. Most people are living in the future, worried about it, what's going to happen, or worrying about the past, missing their whole life, most of the life. So say in any given, you know, 12-hour waking state,
yeah,
how many hours are spent in the future and in the past, and how many hours are spent here, you know? Maybe the smallest percentage for many people is spent here. Until it's not. But often you have to break your mind of that habit just by, and you can do it because of your knowledge. As your knowledge becomes more and more clear, as you recognize Ishwara, that this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara, it's part of a greater story, as that starts to become reasonable and clear to you, and as you recognize your own being as the source of ananda, there's nothing really at stake. See, until you really understand that the ananda that you've been running after, the ananda you've been running after is actually your own being. You've been running after your own being because of self-ignorance. What if you understand, when you get it, when you really, it's what we call aparoksha jnanam, it's direct, immediate recognition of the fact of it, that the ananda, the happiness, the joy, the well-being that you've been seeking is actually your own nature. And that illusion is caused by a shanta vritti that happens when you fulfill a desire. Because at that moment, you're desireless. You fulfill a desire, you're desireless. You're like a mahatma. You have no desire. And so that mind gets a blast of ananda. Because all of a sudden it's become very, very quiet. And that blast of ananda is then projected onto the object because you fulfilled that desire so that you could have that ananda. So when you fulfill the desire, then that object has given you that ananda. And so this goes on and on for lifetimes and lifetimes, beginning with lifetimes, being caught under this illusion. But what about when you recognize that actually it's that shanta vritti that's giving me an mental experience of ananda, because it's not, it's that nature of that vritti is totally in harmony with my own being and not covering me in any way, you know, not competing with me. So then more and more I start to recognize, have viveka, to recognize my own nature, not even the shanta vritti. Shanta vrittis come and go, right? But the self, the ananda, that sacred nature of me, of the self, doesn't come and go. It's not dependent on an ananda vritti, a shanta vritti at all. But now I start to recognize my own being, and now I, the one who is ever present, really who is Brahman, who is the very self of Ishwara, is never not present. And so my mind is always as though bathing in the sanctity of that, of my own being. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm no longer driven by these raga dveshas. They become what we call mitya. They become dugdha bijas, means dugdha is burnt. Mm-hmm. Bija is seed. They all become burnt seeds. It's fine to have these desires, because if they're not fulfilled, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the ananda that I am is free of time. It's not going anywhere. It can't go anywhere. It's not dependent on fulfilling a desire. And so enjoying my own wholeness, then I experience the world. And so what actually becomes natural, very natural for somebody who has knowledge, is a jivanmukta. Jivanmukta means living liberated. I just simply do what is here to be done. That's what I do. There's nothing else that I need to do. This is Ishwara. Everything is just this is Bhagavan's life. This is Bhagavan's life. This is Bhagavan's life. This is Bhagavan's life. So let me, as a jiva, just do what is there being asked to be done. It's very, very simple, because I don't have to fulfill myself. You know? Then these doership and all of this type of stuff becomes mitya. But for a karma yogi, for somebody who is not at home with that knowledge yet, this karma yoga buddhi, where you know, I do my own karma, whatever it comes before me, that gives me. What it gives me is very, very close to what a jnani naturally enjoys. Jnani recognizes there's no kartatvam, there's no dhrishabha, Ishwara. There's only Ishwara here. It's a jnani. The karma yogi is the one who's working to get that knowledge, but now that ahankara is still there for the karma yogi because they're working to get knowledge. And so for that karma yogi, they just do everything that they do is whatever their dharma is, whatever is being asked to be done, not raga dvesha. And so they also enjoy a great deal of shanti, even though the cartridge when the doership is still there. So here in this verse, it says, being committed to their own karmas, the person who's very committed, sway sway kalimani abhiratsaha, happily committed to doing their own duties, samsiddhim labhate naraha. That person, that naraha, labhate, they obtain, that person obtains samsiddhi, means complete success. Complete success in terms of antakarana shuddhi, because that's what we're talking about here. It's not complete worldly success. Complete success in terms of antakarana shuddhi. The ahankara is totally, becomes totally, what do you call, diluted, you know, or dispersed. Because what ahankara is there? Ahankara is totally surrendered to Ishvara. And how does that look? Well, every moment of the day I do what is being asked of me. That is my duty, to do it to the best of my ability. What is my responsibility in this moment? It's not how can I make myself happy or who can I get rid of to be happy. It's in terms of what is being asked of me. That's what I do. And so the person who does that happily commits themselves to their own karma, sway sway karmani abhiratha. They obtain some siddhim, complete success, in reference to the antakarana shuddhi. Then it says, swakarma nirataha siddhim yata vindati tachranu. How such a person, by being devoted to his own karma or her own karma, swakarma nirataha, nirataha being devoted to swakarma, their own karma, how, yata, vindati, how do they gain that siddhim, that success? What does it all mean? How does that work? That they gain success by being devoted to just their own karma, their own dharma, the things that are being asked of them. So how does that work? Yata vindati siddhim, some siddhim. How does that happen? How does it work? Tat shrunu. Listen, I'll tell you. Listen. So we'll stop here. Spinning goes on. Yeah, that's what's coming up. So now we're really getting into the whole karma yoga and how all of that works and how it's important. It's really actually a beautiful section. So. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmane bhyashivamastu nityam loka samasta sukino pavantu kale varushatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamsho barahitah Brahmanasantu nirbhayaha. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha. Sarve santu niramayaha. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amatangamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purna, Purna Mudachate, Purnasya Purna Madhaya Purna Meva Vasishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Hari Om.
It seems to me that the only person that would have, only a mumuksha would have this definition of success. I mean,
well, or a yes and no. There also a dharmi, dharmanishta, somebody who's devoted to dharma, or Ishwara Bhakta, can also, it's not going to be quite the same, but it's close. There's still a dharmanishta, somebody who's devoted to dharma and to Ishwara, is usually working to get to Swargaloka. But they're working to get to Swargaloka, so there's an end, you know, there's an end in sight that exists in samsara. But they will enjoy a great deal of shanti, because everything they do is for the sake of Ishwara. It's very similar. And in fact, just in samsara,
yeah,
the more that one is devoted to dharma as opposed to sensory gratification, where dharma always comes first, that person enjoys much more shanti than a person for whom sensory gratification comes first.
Yeah, what comes to mind is like that woman, that politician, Elizabeth Warren, when she speaks, you can hear this kind of dharmic attitude that I want the well-being for all of us.
Well-being of others, yeah. She's a good kshatriya. She's a kshatriya that has sattva, or she's a brahmana in a kshatriya position.
Yeah.
Regarding part of the meditation, sort of regarding your mind and body as similar to like a part of Ishwara, like a cell is sort of part of your own body.
Mm.
And I was thinking, I think it's difficult for me and probably for a lot of people in the West to, like, when you talk about Ishwara and we use the pronoun he, and we sort of have this idea of this God that's up in the clouds observing and rewarding and punishing people, it's hard to not have that be part of your idea of Ishwara, because that's what it is for us.
Yeah.
And I constantly find myself like correcting that assumption, and I think karma can be difficult in that way, because you sort of see it as reward and punishment, as if someone's up there like rewarding and punishing people. But my question is...
That's true, what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because we have that conditioning, and that conditioning takes place in childhood. So you have already a God image with a lot of emotions attached to it from when you were young.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Ishwara kind of gets superimposed on top of that.
Right.
Yeah.
So my question is, though, if our mind and body are sort of to Ishwara, part of Ishwara, the way like a cell is part of our body, then how can we really know what that is? Like, a cell wouldn't have no idea.
No, and you have no idea either. I would say, not say no idea, but you would have to be able to do an infinite extension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have your little piece of Ishwara here, but to actually have a vision of that infinite Ishwara Swarupa with 7 lokas up and 7 lokas down and be infinite in scope, you know, we're probably smaller than the smallest cell in reference to this body. We're much even less than that. However, you have an experience of Ishwara here within your scope. You have what we call aparoksha, direct, immediate knowledge of your body, mind, sense organs being part of something greater than yourself. Right? It's just that you can't have a vision of his whole Swarupa. You can have some sort of an imagination, but not the actual picture. It's way beyond our scope. That's why, you know, that's why Krishna kind of talks of that in chapter 11 of the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna asked him to see his form.
Mm.
I want to see what you really look like, you know. And Krishna showed him. called a did with a Divya Chakshu, that divine eye, he let Arjuna see. And Arjuna was so overwhelmed by it that he kind of freaked out. And kind of begged Krishna to, first of all, he wanted Krishna, not that, come back into your original form, you know, as Krishna, you know. And then let me just, let's get back to how it was, because it was way too much.
Well, should we have the urge for this infinite extension? I mean, to
have that experience?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I don't have an urge for that.
Because it seems like it'll never fulfill itself. I mean,
that would be sad to have that as a desire. But you don't need it either. You don't need that because the self that you are is the self of Ishwara. You're not a part of Ishwara's self. For the self, there's no time and space for it to be big or large. The very being that you are is the being that Ishwara is. And you can understand, see, just if you understand that there's no difference between you and Ishwara, there's only one self. And the one self that you are is non-dual. It's not that it's big or small, it's that there is no other being. So that you are absolutely, your self-experience at this moment is absolutely complete and is the one self-experience that all beings enjoy. This me. It's a very personal me. So it's not like you have a partial experience of yourself where you're getting, at this time, you're getting a little bit of it. You know, because you're just a little jiva, so you're just having a little bit. No, because the self is not subject to time and space. It's the very self from which time and space comes. Right, so you know who Ishwara is. And now, and also as a jiva, which is made of the same material as the rest of the universe, so, and you have the subtle, Hiranyagarbha and Tejasa. Tejasa is the Sukshma Sharira, and Hiranyagarbha is the infinite Sukshma Sharira. So you're made in your physical body, you know, Vishwa and Virat. Your physical body is made of the same material as this world. Bhagavan has given you this kind of Achilles heel to the reality of this world by giving you your little own piece of Maya. Because you can imagine, you can dream, you can have a lucid dream, you can have an imagination, you can project a snake on a rope, you have this capacity, right? And so, in fact, in the meditations, I can take you on a little journey, you know, imagine a meadow, like the meadow journey and walking through the meadow. You actually have the capacity to recognize yourself as Ishwara in reference to your imagination, or in reference to, I would say, your lucid dream. You know, you are the Ishwara of your imagination, because that Maya, which is, you know, an incidental attribute of its your being, it doesn't change your being in any way. From you, because you have Maya innate as an incidental attribute, you can project a world with people in it. And you can also enter into that world. Right? So that's Ishwara. Now imagine that there's just this very self that you are and the total Maya that projects and what is to us an infinitely huge universe, but that's to us. Like, just think of the cell and the body from its perspective. I mean, this is inconceivable. What the foot is, let alone what the body is, inconceivable. But size is totally relative. It's totally relative. So the size of the whole infinite universe could be small, but not in relationship to us. See what I mean? Not in relationship to this body. So it's infinite. So we're saying it's infinite. It's inconceivable to us. But Maya is not inconceivable to us. We have our own Maya. The relationship between Maya and my being is not inconceivable, because we have that. We can experience that directly, immediately. You know, then we can look at this creation that we find ourselves in as a jiva. Here I am in this creation. We can analyze this creation and recognize, in reality, this is all mithya. There is nothing here but satchit. You cannot find one thing here.
If you analyze it, try to find a thing. You cannot find a thing. It's just names within names within names within names of what? Satchit. That's all. Conscious being. And then if you can go another way. Everything here is coming into being and going out of being. Into being, going out of being. There's only being that is not going into being and out of being. Satchit. You know, so this is only conscious being. Now say we do that same exercise in reference to the dream. Such it, the same thing. But with the dream, I have this kind of Archimedean point, you know, where I can view it from the waking state. I can view the dream from the waking state and realize it's mityatva. But that fact allows me to look at this, the possibility of this enjoying the same mityatva as the dream. And the whole Mandukya, you know, the first... second chapter of the Mandukya does just that. It uses the dream drishtanta illustration to make you see that there's really no difference. You can say, from the standpoint of the dream, the waking state is Swamiji laughing, it's a longer joke, that's all. But in terms of the relationship to your being, both are equally mitya. So, and there's a lot of logic because that's what we went through and we did the whole chapter one.
So. Well, then what do we do with that?
It's just another knocking away the chinks of ajnana to, you know, allow you to relax and enjoy your life. And relax in the wholeness of your being and not worry so much about the world. Honestly. You know, but you have to... because we're conditioned, and some more and others less, we are conditioned worriers. And you have to give that up. You have to give it up as a sadhana. And one, the way to give it up is to keep bringing your mind back to, as a sadhana, bringing your mind back to the present. What is actually here right now? What is happening right now? Let me react to and respond. Even react to, you can say. Let me react to and respond to the moment that is here in front of me. Not to the world that I'm creating. Because my mind will create, in its tendency for catastrophic thinking, it will create whatever horror stories are out there. And then that will trigger my emotions. That's how it works. You know, like we use the example, imagine biting into a lemon. Well, all that sourness comes, you know. You immediately have that salivation, you immediately have that experience of biting into a lemon just by thinking about it. So when you're imagining catastrophic thinking, now this is going to happen and that could happen and that could happen and I'm finished. Then you start to get very sad and upset and all of the emotions that go along with that imagination. That's the power of imagination. The emotions in the body are triggered. And so instead you say, this is my imagination. This is Jiva Srishti. Let me live here in with Bhagavan. Let my devotion be, let me just do what Bhagavan is asking me to do right now. And let me have that shraddha. You just do the best of your ability what is right here. And then you're always clean. You are always doing what is being asked of you to the best of your ability. And as the prarabdha unfolds, some things are not going to be exactly how I want, and some things will be how I want. It doesn't really matter, because my ananda and my well-being isn't dependent upon things, the world pleasing me. That's a very tenuous position. If you say, in order for me to be happy, the world has to shape up according to my specifications so that I can be happy. Right? And what is wrong with Bhagavan? What have I done that Bhagavan is not performing for me in the way that I need him to perform for me? You should say more like, let me perform for Bhagavan in the way he wants me to perform. How about that?
Well, also, there's past is involved too. Past can be as much present as your worry about the future. I mean, there's a separate...
Carrying the tragedies of the past.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some acceptance and things that have to happen with that.
Pardon me?
Some sort of acceptance you have to has to happen with that. Because otherwise all of our... the things that happened with the past, I mean, all of us have been hurt in a variety of ways. I don't think anybody can be born in Kali Yuga and not be have
traumas,
different hurts, you know. But you can grow from those. You can grow from those hurts. You can set them aside, or you can carry them with you.
I'm wondering, listening to this, it seems like maybe worrying and raga dvesha are two distinct things. They overlap a lot, but would you say there are two different ways to get into jiva srishti?
I'd say raga dvesha and worrying kind of go together.
They go together.
They go together because you have a raga, means this. I want this so that I can be happy, right? That means I'm not happy now unless I get that. And so there's a lot at stake there. Mm-hmm. And so then worries come unless I think there's just a clear route. If I don't see a clear route, then my mind says this could go wrong and that could go wrong and this could happen and that could happen. And so I'm going to stress around it until I actually gain the object. And then I'll have a moment of happiness, and then I'll start stressing on how that can be taken away, how I can lose it. So that's why, you know.
So worrying is like an aspect or side effect or
of raga dvesha.
Raga dvesha in full bloom.
Yeah.
Because worrying is desiring and fearing.
Yeah, that worry, fear. Yeah, worry for all of it is part of it. You know, and that's why you only get that moment of relief, because even when you fulfill the desire, you have a moment of desirelessness, but it goes away quickly because too many things can threaten that, you know. And there's other dynamics that happen also, is that you are opened up, you have that ananda, and in the middle of that opening joy of it, your mind all of a sudden goes, now if I could have that too, it would be even better. Yeah, it's outrageous. But it's good to just analyze the whole. Every time you like you fulfilled a desire that you've been working for, and it was a real desire, you know, then notice all of the thought processes leading up to the fulfillment of it, and the emotional life, everything that leads up to the fulfillment of that desire. And then what happens after? And the short little span where your mind is free.
Present.
It's free. Doesn't want anything. But doesn't want anything because it hasn't had a chance to want the next thing. Right? So it's just stunned for a moment.
Well, if you're working with the present, then how does that fit in with what
you when
you're just
working
said?
With the present, the raga dveshas are something which are not your primary concern now. The primary concern is bringing your mind back to the present and doing what needs to be done here. Your raga dvesha are not the primary concern. The primary concern is doing your duty. And in the doing of your duty, the things that are yours will come to you, and the things that are not yours won't come to you, which is exactly the same as if you were worrying, having this desire and that desire, same thing. The things that are yours, the part of it that are yours will come to you, and the things that aren't won't.
So you don't, there's no worry in that respect.
But you spend your life totally worrying, even though in the end it's going to be the same. You'll get what is yours and you won't get what isn't yours. But the whole time you've worried yourself sick and been miserable. Or you could just be in the present and do what is to be done to the best of your ability and enjoy what you have.
That's it.
That's the other thing, Swamiji. I have like a handful of these things that have meant so much to me. And one of the others is enjoy what you have here. What you don't have is infinite, so don't worry about it. It's literally infinite, what you don't have. You know? And even if you think, like in the Prarabdha Karma, how much can you enjoy in one lifetime? Not very much compared to what is there. That's why in the Gita they talk about the samsari. You know, it's like a tree that has buds growing all over, offshoots. You want this, but then it would be nice also to have this and this and this, and this tree keeps growing, growing, and producing more and more buds. You know, it's hard to bring your mind back into some simple clarity. Because the desires keep growing and they keep shooting out new buds, you know, offshoots, desires that are offshoots of the sprouts, like that. So, but what if that's not what you're about? What if you're a mumukshu, and that's not what your life is about?
It's interesting how the mind is set up that, you know, when a desire gets fulfilled, there's a brief period of freedom. But when the seeking, you know, the raga dveshas are operating, it seems like getting that thing is going to be the be-all, end-all, and everything's going to be fine for you. And it gets applied to even to moksha, too. I mean, it's across the board.
But what they say about moksha, that is the one benign desire. It is a desire, and it causes stress also. But it's a benign desire because it takes you to the very timeless source of ananda, of the source of what you're actually seeking. And so if that desire fulfills itself in a real way. The other desires are all mithya, and they don't fulfill themselves at all, actually.
That was really good, though.
Yeah.
What you just said, because that just shows how silly it is.
But that is what a raga is.
Yeah.
Each one has that. Well, there are little ones too, but this is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, that's sure. That's ignorance. I mean, that's not being focused.
Yeah, it's a total ignorance, which encompasses us, all of us. That's why it works so well, because we're all in it together. You know? Except for a few wise people.
It's democratic, is that right?
Yeah, everybody is totally encompassed by it, you know, except for a few wise people and mumukshus. Mumukshus who by law will gravitate to their teacher, you know, because they've recognized there's a problem here, a big problem, because you have an innate desire to be whole and complete, because that is your nature. And so it's just totally confusing and not right to be incomplete, you know. Yeah, it's not right.
Agitation.
It's almost like what I just got from what he said, Michael said, was like, you know, you're going after object X, whether it's profound or small or whatever, and you're unconsciously just telling yourself this complete lie that when I get that, I'm going to be okay. And, you know, your IQ is like diminished to zilch. I mean, you know, and then you get it, and then the problem is, it probably would be better if you didn't have the freedom, because then you'd stop. Anyway, you have this brief period, and during which you think that the lie was true, then there's this, oh crap, it left, and then you remember that it left again all those other times. Why don't you remember it when you're going for the next desire? That the last 8 billion desires also ended.
Yeah.
And unhappiness.
Absolutely. Until that billionth upon billionth time.
And then you remember.
Yeah. And then you go, wait.
Maybe we need to inquire into the
which number is it?
During it.
For you.
The next one.
But that's why, you know, really inquiring into the whole mechanics of desire and how all that works is so useful.
Yeah.
You have to tell good stories around that. Swamiji has some great stories.
Fun.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us.
I've told them.
Oh, I'll
tell them again, though. Not tonight, but okay. I'll tell them.
It sounded like there were some more.
Yeah.
Where you said that.
But I haven't told those for a while. I'll tell them.
This Gita is marvelous.
It is. Gita has everything. It has the all the knowledge of the Upanishads and all of the means that you need, the skills that you need, you know, for the Antakarana Shuddhi.
Mm.
So that's why it says it's both an Upanishad and a Yoga Shastra.
Wow.
When they say Yoga Shastra, they mean Antakarana Shuddhi.
Well, that's how it praises itself, isn't
yeah.
it?
Well, that's how the in those ending, that ending verse every time is a praise of that chapter. I don't know who actually added those ending verses on. Like, gives a title to the chapter and praises Krishna and Arjuna and that Samvada, that dialogue.
Mm.
You know, praises it as a Yoga Shastra and that Upanishad.
Marvelous tonight.
Mm.
As usual.
Hi, Sana. Hi, Maitreya. Hi, Lita. Hi, Colin, user number 3. I'm not sure who you are. Hi, Belinda. Hi, Anne.